So I'm going to talk about something somewhat different, an optical survey. And we did do some ESSI observation of some of the optical cluster, but I will not show any ESSI map because you will laugh if you see them. But they were from a few years ago. So now I'm sure that with all these new instruments, they will pick these things up in no time. So I'm going to talk about the RCS, Red Sequence Cluster Survey. This is a rather large survey that have entering its 10th year. And as all good surveys, you always have a 1 and a 2. And over the year, the people that we accreted listed here, plus other that I didn't list, because I don't know their name or I don't know how to spell their names. And the RCS started as Mike Gladys' thesis about 10 years ago or 11 or 12 years ago. And Mike has since gone on to be a faculty at University of Chicago. And most of the people in this list have been in Toronto at one time or another as my student or postdoc or collaborator. Here's a short outline. I'm going to give a little, very brief summary of the RCS just to show you the method of finding clusters. And then I'm going to present primarily three results that have to do with cosmology. I will not talk about anything about galaxy evolution, which actually there are many more papers on galaxy and galaxy cluster evolution from RCS than cosmology. The three things I talk about, one is a rather old paper on cosmological result from RCS1. Some results that were literally hot off the press was sent to me only a couple of days ago from Mike, who is observing lenses, in fact, at WHT at La Palma on strong lens statistics. And finally, I will talk about these two sort of somewhat connected. It's using galaxy cluster redshift 1 and above to look for supernovae, which one actually see that that's sort of a slight twist on what you can use cluster in doing cosmology. So this is my rationale for doing galaxy cluster survey and galaxy cluster work. And you can see that most of the time in this conference, we talk about go for structure and how it links to the measurement of cosmological parameters. But obviously, galaxy cluster has a lot to do with galaxy evolution, allow us to look at how galaxies form and evolve in vastly different environment. And finally, this is sort of an interesting motivation, which actually, when we wrote proposal for the survey for RCS2, this is actually the second major scientific goal, and that is to find enough strong gravitational lenses to do both statistics, which we didn't have a lot of high hope, but I will show you some results. But more importantly, we want to use it as gravitational lens telescope, where you magnify high redshift galaxy by a factor anywhere from 2 to 20. And if you have a big enough survey with enough clusters, you actually sample enough volume at high redshift to make it interesting, to actually get a representative sample. Now, I think for people who've been around for a while, doing galaxy cluster survey really only come to its modern form about 10 years ago. And primarily because there isn't big aerial detectors. So a modern galaxy cluster survey, well, I think 10 to the 2 is a little bit too small these days. You need to go to 10 to the 3 square degree. You want to go to redshift at least 1 or bigger in order to get enough lever arm in either galaxy evolution or cosmology. And a very important part of doing cluster survey, which you can see most of the old survey, like a Bell survey and PDCS, is that they don't really able to obtain these two characterization of the sample, which is very important. You need to have the redshift, and you need to have a mass, or more correctly, some sort of mass proxy mass observable. Otherwise, your sample is not very useful. And I don't just mean doing cosmology. When you want to do cluster physics, galaxy evolution, you want to pick your sample, you know, based on hopefully these two parameters. So if you don't have the two, you weren't able to say very much, or at least that is robust. Now, there are three ways of cluster survey. I didn't put down the fourth way, weak lensing, because that I think that is a very expensive way. Eventually, I'll be able to do that with LSST, et cetera. And optical IR is actually the most efficient or the cheapest, in a sense that if you go down here, it's a factor of 10 roughly in cost every time. Okay? You know, it's 100 million, tens of million, and about a million to do a big survey. So it's actually very gratifying to see that they're actually cluster detected in SZ survey now. I think this is the first time in conference I've seen an example of it, of like a known cluster that detected by SZ. So optical search for cluster. Well, everybody can identify a cluster. If an undergraduate see this picture, they say there's a galaxy cluster there. Here's COMA at redshift 0.025. Now, in a relatively heroic effort in the 80s using CCD at Palomar, Gunn-Oak and Hessel did this Palomar deep cluster survey, trying to find high redshift cluster. So here's one of the cluster they find. And I would say that you'd be hard put to know there's a cluster, you know, other than having these square based on spectroscopic redshift being plotted there. So at high redshift, you have this large column of galaxy that you need to look through. So excess on the sky become problematic as a parameter to choose your cluster. And the revival of modern IR optical cluster survey, besides having these large detector available, rather than just fire up minute times fire up minute CCDs, you also have a slew of these new methods, which based on multi-filter data. And the first one to use this kind of method is the rest sequence method survey. And we started this about 1998. And the idea is very simple. You plot color versus magnitude of galaxy in the sky toward a cluster. The elliptical galaxy would form a red sequence. They're the reddest galaxy at that redshift, modulo dust. And so anything that is redder than it is behind the cluster. Anything bluer than it is either in the cluster, behind the cluster, or in front of you. But along this narrow strip, you have relatively small number of contaminant. And you only need two filters, you know this, so it's very efficient. And a color matrix diagram is Z band versus R minus Z. In K correction, as you go to different redshift, your band is shifted in color. And that also allow you, first of all, allow you to search for cluster. And secondly, once you get the color, you can estimate its redshift. And this is a demonstration how it works. If you take a CCD picture, you do all the you count all the galaxies, and you come up with a density map of galaxy that looks like that. So you're hard pressed to say where is the cluster, or are there any clusters? Now, if you isolate the galaxy catalog to only color at the sequence of in the color slice, that's equivalent to redshift 0.9 elliptical, all of a sudden you see a lot more signal. And so you pick up the peaks. In fact, I would say you actually see sort of filament structure. So let's say you picked up the peak on this picture, the highest one, and you indeed there's a cluster, redshift 0.89, spectroscopically confirmed. And in the next picture, these are real data, galaxy density at different redshift slice as you move through the color, and you can see how structure come in and out, and you identify these things in 3D. So this is not simulation, okay? This is real data. So that's the method for using rest sequence. And as I said, the bonus of it is when you have a color matrix diagram like this, you get the rest shift simply by noting where the rest sequence is. And so from RCS1, this is actually not one of the earlier. We have more rest shift than this now. This is spectral Z versus photo Z, and the typical uncertainty depending on where you are is for about 0.0 to 0.06. With RCS2, which we have done much more work in calibrating the photometry and uniformity. This is just a sample of clusters that were taken by Mike's group for lensing with the photo Z versus spectral Z. And I put this, try to put in the same scale. And you can see that the scatter is much smaller. In fact, the scatter for that set of galaxies is around 0.015. So we can actually get extremely good photo Z just using two filters. So here are the two redshift surveys. RCS1 is very modest compared to today, but at the time when we started, it was a big survey using a 1/3 square degree camera, the CFX12K, and relatively short exposure. And we look at both at CFXD and CTI, we look at patches that are about 2.5 degrees square. These are some of the samples. The cosmology parameter result I'm going to talk about comes from this set of data. The RCS2 started when CFXT commissioned the MegaCam and 1 square degree camera about 5 years ago. And it's a 1,000 square degree survey. And the idea here is that to do something the next time, you need to do a factor of 10 bigger. And also, 1,000 square degree allow you to get enough cluster to get a handle on W. And this is a combined Canada-Taiwan collaboration. Taiwan bought some CFXT time, and they were convinced to donate some time to the project. And you see exposure is actually extremely short. We decided to pull back a little bit because we realized that with Z-band, we don't really find redshift 1 cluster all that well. We do OK at redshift 0.9, so that's going too deep. Rather than going deeper, we sort of try to get a minimum depth where we can actually detect rich cluster redshift 1. Now, at lower redshift, we can go down in the mass function probably by a factor of 2 or 3. There's a website if you're interested in looking at where we pointed. So the main goal here is to constrain cosmological parameter, as I already mentioned, to generate a large sample of strong lenses. Obviously, we want to look at cluster evolution with tens of thousands of clusters. The wide field also allows us to do a very large scale weak lensing cosmic shear analysis. And this time, we actually have 4 filters for most of our field, 3 for all of them. So we're able to generate photo Z of millions of galaxies. Useful up to about redshift 0.7. And the cluster samples are optimized between redshift 0.1 and 1. And we expect the order of around 10,000, 15,000, sort of around 10 to the 14 solar mass clusters. So this is MegaCam, 36 CCD. These are not used. And this is a big camera. You can see that one image is almost a gigabyte. And so compared to a human head, so next time when someone tell you how big their Nikon or Canon is, tell them you have a 325 megapixel camera somewhere. This is the sky coverage, the white squares. We do it in about 12 patches. The yellow area, that's what the UKIS IR survey. So we try to pick area that are either along the equator, so we can use telescope from both north and south to do north and south to do follow up, or in fields that already have a lot of other data. And so a typical patch looks like this: 9 times 9, so 80 square degree or so, and each one of this square is one pointing of the MegaCam, and one MegaCam looks like this with 36 CCD. Each chip has about 5,000 objects in it. And the size of the moon is that. And the size of the moon in the patch is this. So we end up with sort of the order of 100 million object catalog. So the observing part of it has been completed in January 2008, more than a year ago. We obtained about 770 square degree of data And when we add the publicly available, or available to Canadian, and soon to be publicly available to everyone, 150 square degree from the legacy Y survey, we come up with about 1,000 square degree. And the photometry catalog are mostly complete. We're just dealing with a few nasty pointings. And primary cluster catalogs have been generated. And you will see the picture of this a few times. This is the RCS2 poster child, a 3 or 4 × 10⁴ solar mass cluster with a arc about 45 arcseconds away from the center, at redshift 0.7. We think this is certainly the, well, it's likely the most massive cluster. Say that again. Well, this is a slightly old slide. The latest number I have is 3.5. Okay.
Times 10 to 15. You said 10 to the 14.
No, 15.
Okay.
15. No. Yeah. This number is there's no error in this.
Okay.
I will show you a little more data on this. But you can look at this picture. Well, I mean, on the screen you don't see it very well, but if you look at it on the laptop, you see the number of galaxies is striking.
X-rays?
Yes, I will show you a lot of data, another slide of data on this. So now let me talk a little bit about cosmology. This is from a paper from 2007. So I probably wouldn't say too much about it other than pointing out that you can do cosmology with optical cluster, as Gus also mentioned with Sloan catalog yesterday. And so here is the count that you try to fit, and the main thing that's the tricky part is, you know, how do you link the mass observable to the real mass? And this is using only 72 square degree of data from RCS1. RCS1's data are not quite homogeneous enough. Some of them are not deep enough or have calibration, photometric calibration problems. So those are removed, leaving 72 square degree. And so one need a mass observable, and the one that we use is this richness parameter called galaxy cluster correlation amplitude, which is essentially if you count the galaxy from the center of the cluster with certain radio law, and then you have this amplitude, and this is the amplitude we use as a richness parameter. But it's essentially a excess number of galaxy in certain radii. And like everything in astronomy, if you don't know how to relate mass to your mass observable or any real quantity to a observable quantity, you make it into a power law. So we write it as a power law of the richness parameter with a normalization constant plus a evolution in the form of 1 plus z to the gamma. And we able to do something like that. This is just a plot to show that BGC and velocity dispersion from CNOC and from the equivalent stack lensing analysis that Hank did on some RCS1 cluster, that there is some sort of correlation. Now, but we actually don't use whatever empirical measurement that we have from this. Instead, Suba is the one who did all the cosmological calculation, applying his self-calibration method to the data. So the result, based on a 7-parameter fit of 1,000 clusters, and the 7-parameter, well, actually there's only really 5 parameters that we fitted, the omega m sigma 8, H with WM prior, and the N W map prior. And then there are 3 cluster parameter based on this equation. Well, this equation actually produced 2 because we combine these 2 parameter into the mass limit. And then we add scatter in the relationship, which turned out to be quite important. This is the Markov chain input prior that we put into analysis. This is the count as a function of redshift. You can see there's sort of the order of hundreds of clusters per bin here. we limit our redshift from 0.35 to about 0.9, 0.95 or so, where 0.35, the survey wasn't blue enough, and 0.95, things start becoming not, you know, probably have all kind of selection problem, we think. This is the marginalized likelihood of the different parameters. So H basically is a prior. So you look at these five, and here's the omega M and sigma 8 with the one sigma result, which you can see is consistent with WMAP results. And this is for more detailed tables. And if we actually put in priors based on what we measure between the correlation between the richness parameter and, let's say, dynamical mass, and we basically get the same result. Here are the banana diagram, though none of them look like bananas. Is omega m sigma 8. And the interesting thing here is the scatter, which is shown in the next plot. When we did this at first, we just either we didn't do put in a scatter and then put in a fixed scatter and then leave scatter as a free floating parameter. And it scatter actually have, you can see, have a huge effect on what you get in sigma 8. So basically, the larger scatter, you don't need such a high sigma 8 to account for the richer objects. And so we have this tail, a long tail in sigma 8, because we don't know the scatter very well. And also, the mass limit that we observe to is also sort of depending on the scatter, in the sense if the scatter is small, the mass limit you can determine much better. But once the scatter is large, then the mass limit becomes free floating quite a bit. The interesting thing is when you measure the mass these parameters, the one in red is what is sort of the best fit parameters for the cluster mass relationship. And the one in blue is what have been measured using different samples. They're not very large samples, but they actually turn out to be, you know, entirely consistent, including the scatter in the relationship between BGC and dynamical mass. So we come to the same conclusion as Gus yesterday, that optical cluster is actually useful, and you can use it to produce cosmological constraint. And of course, it's from a very small sample with large air bar. We'll see what happened with a larger sample that go out to redshift 1. Now, along the line of this, I want to just show some X-ray result. We observe 13 RCS cluster in the high redshift regime using Chandra. And out of these 13, 12 were detected. It turned out the 13th one, later on when we go back in the new catalog, you know, we couldn't find that cluster either in the optical data. So that was sort of a mistake somehow. At least we were confused as to what, you know, where that cluster, which cluster actually was. But you can see that we have reasonable data which we can actually measure profile and temperature for many of them. No. The one that disappeared, or the one that we didn't detect, it turned out in the new catalog is actually, there was a real redshift problem. And, but it's not, no, we don't have a most massive cluster that disappeared in X-ray. I don't know why you hear that.
No, but one of, how sure of this cluster were you before you sent it off to be observed with Chandra?
I don't think I quite remember how sure we are. A lot of these clusters, when we get time for it, we don't have spectroscopic redshift, and it comes from a preliminary cluster catalog.
You know, the Chandra police are everywhere.
you notice if you were in the Chandra pack, the proposal we put in last time, every single one has spectroscopic confirmation.
You'll never get time again. Hopefully, I'll never be on an X-ray tech.
No, it turned out that one, we didn't have spectroscopic confirmation, and we still don't have it. So, and it's not that rich a cluster. It depends on what redshift you assign to it, the richness. And now, here's another example of one of the Chandra observation. This is a cluster with lots of arcs, very rich. And when you look at the red sequence distribution of galaxy, you see all these structures, including three very high lumps. And sure enough, in X-ray, they all show up. So this is actually a supercluster with a projected distance here of about 5 megaparsec at redshift 0.9. And each one is several times 10 to the 14 solar masses. So when they merge, let's say by redshift 0.6, 0.7, they would be a 10 to the 15 solar mass cluster, assuming they merge. And this is just a pretty picture that David Gilbank made, that combine the X-ray in purple and the galaxies in the cluster. So it's quite remarkable to see sort of three of these things with point sources on the sky this close. And this is just some of the spectroscopic data where the big blue dots are redshift 0.9 galaxies spectroscopically confirmed, plotted on top of the red sequence structure. And we have about twice as many spectroscopy data on this at this point, but I still have it. I think they are sort of the order of 5 to about 2. I don't know whether David remember that times 10 to the 14. So I think this is the most massive one, and I think this is the least massive. But they are sort of in the 10 to the 14 regime based on both X-ray and dynamical. From the 13 RCS sample, I'm just going to show one result since we talked about F-gas. This is from Molly Hicks' thesis in a paper that came out last year. What we plot here is F-gas versus TX. So if there is a correlation between sort of the mass of the cluster and F-gas, one can take that out from sort of this relationship that what people expect or fit. And what you see is that even if you just do in a very narrow range of TX, there's a real difference between the sample redshift 0.3 from CNOT and the RCS sample. We choose these two samples because we know about these two samples. They are both that data are analyzed by ourselves pretty consistently rather than from the literature. They're very similar data.
Which radius do you actually measure F-gas?
I believe it's R2500.
Yeah.
Yeah,
oh,
so
sorry.
Yeah.
Do you see a difference, a drop by about 30%, 40% or so?
The difference, this is log. So from here to here, it's about a factor of 2, right?
Oh.
This is 1 point. Is that 1.2? Anyway, it's 5, 6, 7, 8. So this is a factor of 2. So this is actually a histogram where you see the factor of 2, 0.05, 0.045, above a factor of 2. And those two histograms are significant at 99 something.
It's measured within the same relative radius?
Yeah, same R2500, they all measure.
It's small redshift and high redshift?
This is redshift point. This is the redshift range for the blue histogram, and this is the redshift range for the red histogram. Now, the caveat here is these are optically selected, this is X-ray selected. So there are either A, things that evolve, or B, when you select object from optical and X-ray, you're going to get different F-gas. Now, we have a Chandra program, which we have time in which we're going to observe an RCS sample at this redshift range with similar richness as the CNOT sample, so we can do a direct comparison and resolve, you know, what is producing this different evolution or sample selection.
This one was optical?
This one is optical, and this one is X-ray selected.
So it's not surprising because you should see gas, you see probably.
It may be not surprising. So we don't know whether it's an evolution or a sample selection. So we need, you know, one set of these. Now, you know, at higher redshift, there are actually not that many cluster at around redshift 1 in X-ray, so we Okay, so let me go to lensing. And this is work mostly by people in my graduate school with some other collaborators using Sloan also to add to it. And with RCS1, we published a paper based on about 6 or 7 strong arcs that were found in 70 or 80 square degree. And when you compare to the model at that point, those were the model from, for example, Badelman from late 1990s, we find there seems to be an excess of strong arc. But of course, the statistics small. There are other people looking at EMS, S cluster, et cetera, also find this likely to be the case. And that caused a flurry of people redoing the model and everything. Part of the excess at that time was explained by the fact that the initial models that were built by people were relatively simple, and they put a sheet of background galaxy probably at relatively too low a redshift to produce enough arc that one will observe. So RCS2 being 10 times bigger, we expect that we'll find 100 to 150 of these big arc system. Now, unfortunately, with this light right here, you're not going to see very much of it. But you can trust me that you will see there are arcs. Like the arc is right here, but you don't see it. It's called surface brightness effect.
It's like having a moonlit sky here. So you know.
This one you'll see. No doubt about that one. In fact, that's probably the prettiest one. And here's another one which you won't see because it's right here. And anyway, they're actually quite spectacular if this room is dark. And it's okay. We'll just, you can turn down the light. There's another picture. And we also find lenses that are basically produced by more or less a single galaxy, which we haven't done any work on, but you can see that some of them are quite spectacular also. And as I mentioned, one of the objectives of doing this is to use cluster as a gravitational lens telescope. So in this case, this is in the paper written by David Gilbank on this cluster, on this particular, actually this is the most massive cluster of those three clusters that I've shown you before. And so this arc here is a redshift 3.8. You can see that with Gemini. This is Gemini, David. And even with Gemini, you can get very high signal-to noise spectra, UV spectra of the with all the absorption line there. And so in theory, that will allow you to study these things in great detail, not only just because it's magnified, also because you stretch them. So you actually have better spatial resolution if you wish to do things, for example, velocity versus position on the sky. The interesting thing is, okay, Swicki predicted lensing 1933, or one of the people who did. And the first one was found in 1986. Well, it was found earlier, but it took many years before they come to the conclusion it was lens. And that's about 370. And 0024 that everybody know about. And then the number of these strong arc, and I don't mean like arc. Basically, you look at a rich enough cluster with HSD deep enough, you see some little arc. These are big arcs, okay? The number actually did not come up very fast. RCS1 saw add a number to them at about 2,000. This is this little jump here. And then the Sloan people did some search. And we think that with RCS2, we're going to go up here. And in the next decade, when you have all these big imaging surveys, there should be thousands of these things. So we need to think about what to do with them. Because most of the time, when people have one of these arcs, they just spend a lot of time beating it to death. But you have 1,000 of these. One need to approach these things somewhat differently, thinking more in long statistics. This is actually a mosaic that Mike Glatter made and sent to me. A lot of these are actually from Sloan, deeper images of Sloan arcs. And you can see, you know, there are all these wonderful looking things. out there. So let's look at some statistics. These are interim statistics that we obtained so far. So one, let's look at the direct search from RCS2 data. And this is search using eyeball. Okay, so it's not a automated search. And the idea here is you know where the cluster is, you look at the cluster, and then you decide whether there's an arc or not. Since the thing we're looking for is quite obvious, I actually think it's reasonably complete because, for example, a so-called complete sample here is something with Einstein radius bigger than 5 arc second and the length to width ratio bigger than 10. And in this area that might search, there are 27 cluster lenses. And the number that we'd expect using this rather strict criteria is about 75 in the whole survey when it's all done. And if you go to, if you weaken the condition, there are probably hundreds of these things in the RCS2. So this is the poster child that I mentioned before. Here's the arc. And I guess the arrow have moved. Ignore those arrows. Here's the center of the cluster. This arrow should be pointed at here. These other arrows should be pointed at these pink objects, which are some weird high redshift object that are lensed. And this thing has a redshift of about 3. And this is the X-ray image where the primary X-ray temperature that I believe Molly Hicks determines around 10 keV. These are all the spectroscopic data we have so far. As you can see, the absorption line galaxy, there are about 105 of them, is measured by the black histogram and the fit. And these are blue emission line galaxy, AGN, and starburst galaxies. And you see that they have somewhat different velocity dispersion. But using just the absorption line galaxies, or red galaxies, you come up with a velocity dispersion around 1400 kilometers per second, which standard calculation gives you a real mass, the order of several times 10 to the 15. So this is a very massive cluster. Okay, this is about 3 times COMA and about 1.5 or twice times a Bell 1680. 2 minutes. Okay.
Is the X-ray met?
We haven't looked at that yet. We have X-ray. So, but anyway, I just want to show you this. But let me go on and show you a lensing statistic. So here are the model from Hanari et al. And this is what we have. These are for different sigma 8. You can see that this predicts a sigma 8 of somewhere around 0.9. A better plot is here. The total number, cumulative count, the total number of count, and the expected number from their model, which is an embodied ray tracing model. And you can see again, the best is around 0.9. If you look at redshift distribution, it is also around 0.9. And the might also be analysis of looking at the Einstein radius of these lenses. It combines several sources of lenses, which have this different color. So if it's the legacy survey, RCS2, and Sloan direct search. And then he corrected for the depth of the different survey. They also line up, so it's the distribution of Einstein radius. These are the model from O'Geary and Branford for different sigma 8 based on a different WMAP result, and also based on whether the background is at redshift 3 or redshift 1. And the year 5 result is this. So you can see that you use the WMAP year 5 sigma 8. You're basically missing all these lenses. Now, the redshift distribution of the arc is more likely to be a redshift 1.5 than a 3. So this is really a sort of a really high redshift estimate for the source. And so there's basically a shortage of lenses if you use those models. And it generally sort of demand prefer a higher sigma 8, around 0.9. But as we heard from Netta's talk, there are other issues in doing lensing, such as the how elongated clusters are, how much merging there is. So there is some issue that can be resolved also using models. what model you're going to use. And in 0 minutes, I will mention the cluster supernova survey that saw parameters, the PI that we did in the last few years, where we actually point HST at high redshift clusters to look at supernovae from elliptical galaxies. So here's one, and with spectra that look like this from the ground that let you know that that's this SN1. And this is sort of the diagram that shows how much more efficient it is in getting supernovae. This is a supernovae from the survey in host galaxy that are spiral and elliptical. You can see that there's this big bump here of elliptical galaxy, of which a large percentage come from cluster elliptical. So you're increasing the amount of, for example, supernovae in elliptical galaxy by about a factor of 2.5. And supernovae in elliptical galaxies are useful because they have a much lower dispersion because you don't have to correct for dust. If you put in a fiducial cosmological model, here's the residual of the supernovae that are in galaxies that are not in elliptical host, and here's the residual for supernovae in elliptical. You can see that the standard deviation is different by a factor of 4. So you can say one supernova in elliptical is worth 16 supernovae in spiral galaxy. So it's very worthwhile to find very rich clusters so you can get a lot of supernovae. Not only get more supernovae, but you get these valuable supernovae. And I just want to mention that we are also carrying out a high redshift cluster survey using Spitzer's wire data combined with ground-based Z-band data to find redshift bigger than 1 clusters. And so we have an example of these, and we have 6 of these with spectroscopic confirmation. And let me just show one. So for example, these are redshift 1.2 with a velocity dispersion measurement. We are very effective in finding them. And so they would basically add a lot to lengthen the redshift baseline for the cluster survey. Okay.
So I'm actually going to ask the first question. So how's the redshift distribution for European arcs? Because at some point there was a problem that it seemed like there were a lot of arcs at high redshift compared to low redshift.
That turned out not to be a big issue now with the new models. I think there is a plot in here once my computer comes back to me. So
this one you showed?
This one.
Okay, that has a mean.
Yeah, it's this one. No, this is a redshift distribution. This redshift and so this is the RCS redshift distribution, and this is the model that Hanawi et al. When we scale the model to what we expect to find. So you can see, depending on sigma 8, we change this a lot, what the redshift distribution look like. So you can see, you know, you run into a problem if you think sigma 8 is 0.65. This is flat almost. But when sigma 8 is, you know, 0.8, 0.9, then you get the right distribution. I think the issue comes from the old model were very simple-minded, which, you know, what you expect 10 years ago.
Would this model include cluster substructure or stuff like this that could boost the lensing cross-section?
The Hanawi paper is based on embodied simulation and ray tracing, so presumably that is included, whereas the Ogarian-Branford model are based semi-analytical, and that would not include.
Thanks. In principle, I mean, I guess the Berry anticipation can also increase the mass inside of time.
Yes, there are.
That actually boosts the lensing signal, yeah. Which actually increases the
I think there are 3 issues here. sigma 8, the shape of the cluster, as one that I'll talk about, and also the concentration in the core of the cluster. Now, you know, in theory, when you have a lot of these lenses, you can start getting some information on that and get a distribution of what these central concentration of mass look like. Of course, you only see the tail of it, but at least you have some idea whether it matches what you expect from n-body simulation. So I think all those three effects could be at play. You know, if you insist sigma 8 equal to 0.8, then you're going to have to get those other two effects to bring the number up.
I think one way to check for whether it's elongation or merging or something along the line of sight to separate it from sigma 8 effect is if you have, as you do, the X-ray emission, I mean, just to collect data from the different wavelengths. So if you have the X-ray emission, the temperature, the velocity dispersion, the temperature, each one will be affected differently by elongation
right.
or
mm-hmm.
merging. The X-ray contours, at least as I can see, they don't seem to suggest sort of two clumps or bimodal distribution or so. And if the temperature is consistent with velocity dispersion, temperature is not affected much mm-hmm. by elongation, whereas velocity dispersion will be affected much since, you know, it's.
So I didn't have time. I just ran through that one new graph where it showed the follow-up project we're doing on these lens clusters. So Mike Grado, who built the Gizmo image slicer thing for IMAX, which I guess Dennis will know about, in which you can get many slits in the central 3-arc minute of the field. So he has done multi-optic spectroscopy for 20 of these arcs now, getting 15 to 100 member redshift per cluster. And we also put in Chandra proposal. So far, we haven't got time yet. So in fact, we will get, for example, dynamical and X-ray hydrostatic mass, plus, you know, weak lensing mass when we collect enough data.
And the other thing you can do, you can combine an SD if you have the SD for this cluster and then the X-ray.
Yeah.
And if you get a very wrong H-naught from the ratio,
and I believe,
you know that it's elongated.
And I believe John Carlson's group has been roped into doing SD for these things.
I've been roped into it? Yeah. You showed probably 8 clusters for which we already have SD.
I see, okay.
And of the 3 projects we've got going on, one of them is precisely that. Take X-ray observed clusters, take the SD, and from the elongation.
Mm-hmm. So I would say the X-ray is probably the most difficult data to get.
Well, we're taking ones for which we already have.
Mm.
I think if you can reduce the elongation amount, I mean, if you can reduce that problem, either show that that's a problem or reduce it, then you're off to either sigma 8 is very high, and I don't know how high you have to be in order to do this. I can
it's about 0.9.
Above
0.9, 0.95. So.
Well, yeah, that's consistent with what...
It's not terribly high, yes.
No. It's consistent within some of the observation. That's all. I also thought that we don't know that it's very, very
important. Okay, well, thank Howard again. And,